Have you ever walked into a room and immediately forgotten why you're in there? Do you feel a slight panic when you can't remember the name of that actor in that movie that you love so much? Do you find it difficult to recall what you had for lunch last Thursday? If so, you may have also wondered if these moments of forgetting are normal or a cause for concern. In the new book, Remember, Lisa Genova explains how the majority of these kinds of memory lapses are completely normal, and we don't need to feel fear when we experience them, because while memory is an extraordinary superpower, it is also far from perfect. Lisa Genova is the New York Times bestselling novelist who is responsible for Still Alice, which was adopted into an Oscar-winning movie starring Julianne Moore. What you may not know is that in addition to being an acclaimed novelist, she is a Harvard-educated neuroscientist who has spent the last decade speaking about Alzheimer's and other neurological diseases. The new book is Remember, the Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting. It is published by Harmony, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Lisa Genova to the roundtable this morning. Lisa, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
What got you into wanting to write about this, and beginning with what we described in the introduction as just what is normal when it comes to our lapses in memory?
I've been talking about Alzheimer's for over a decade and using Still Alice as a vehicle for conversation about this subject, which is pretty scary to most people. And what I found was that while the talks and the conversations always began with Alzheimer's, they always migrated eventually to memory and forgetting in general. And so folks would approach me in the book signing line or the VIP, you know, after talk party, or in the ladies' room, they'd corner me and sort of confess their deepest secrets of, you know, I have to write everything down that I plan to do later, or I'll forget to do it. Or I'm always having trouble coming up with people's names, and I can never remember where I put my glasses. I'm really scared and stressed and panicked, and actually even feel shamed that this is going on because I'm worried that I'm about to get Alzheimer's. Is that what's going on? You know, my mom has Alzheimer's. I'm now worried that I'm already showing symptoms. And these folks were practically expecting me to diagnose them in this very conversation. And so what I did instead was explain to everyone one at a time that, no, this is, you know, the price of playing poker here as a human is that we come with brains that have memory systems that are amazing and incredibly flawed. And so these types of forgetting that plague us every day are totally normal and not a reason to jump to, oh my God, I might be getting Alzheimer's. And so I would see the fear sort of wash away and see people exhale and relax. And I was sort of disseminating this education, this sort of transformational education, one person at a time. And I thought, you know, it's time to get this down in a book and sort of help people in mass.
What does it say about how we have scared people about Alzheimer's too, though? I mean, that if you forget where you put the keys, that's the immediate leap that you make.
Yeah. And so, you know, we do as a culture, we place so much importance on intellect and memory. And on the one hand, I can understand why that's so, right? Because memory is so essential to the functioning of almost everything we do. And it's so linked to identity in that, you know, I have a sense of who I've been and who I am because I can remember. You know, my personal history is my biography. It's my identity. And so if you've ever witnessed someone stripped bare of their personal history by Alzheimer's, it's justifiably terrifying and heartbreaking and a devastating way to end a beautiful life with that disease. But they're not the same thing. So, you know, forgetting, you know, where you parked your car is probably a symptom of distraction and has nothing to do with your memory. You probably didn't pay attention to where you parked it in the first place. And you can't form a memory of anything unless you pay attention to it. So it probably has to do with that and not to impending Alzheimer's. I think we jump to it because it's one of the scariest outcomes that can happen as a human being.
it's interesting because what I think you do beautifully in this book is try to make us feel better about the fact that we have these moments, and that if you're writing yourself notes and you have yourself a list of things that you don't forget, that somehow is cheating. And you say, okay, whatever it takes, though. You make that seem okay.
Yeah, again, there's this big misconception and sort of misbelief out there that if I Google the words that are on the tip of my tongue, that I'm going to weaken my memory and make it even worse. And if I write to-do lists, then that's cheating, and I'm you know, doing something sneaky, and you know, I'm doing it because I have a weak memory and I'm getting old and it's failing on me. And none of those are true. And we're being so unnecessarily hard on ourselves and punishing ourselves in ways that really aren't fair. And we don't have to do these. We don't have to think that way. So think about this, folks. Our prospective memories, which is our memory for our ability to remember what to do later, is so flawed in every human brain. Does your teenager ever remember to turn off the bedroom light when leaving the room? No. Do airline pilots use checklists and not rely on their memories to remember to put the wheels down before landing the plane? Thankfully, yes. So there's no shame in a list. There's no shame in using Google to look up the word that you cannot remember the name of that actor or that movie your friend recommended. You can look it up. This is not going to weaken your memory's ability whatsoever. It's not going to protect you from like, oh, well, I won't forget where I put my phone later if I can just muscle in the name of that actor on my own. So it doesn't make your memory any weaker for looking it up. So you have my permission to use Google if a word's stuck on the tip of your tongue.
You write to us if not that we need more understanding on this or more comfort. It is that you talk about memory studies and you say that when it comes to research, most of the study of memory was focused on remembering, and forgetting was thought to be passive, and which was an error of memory. But recently, we've begun to realize that forgetting is the other half of a memory system that is, wait for it, actually working. So talk a little bit about that we do need to forget, and that it is active and motivated and intentional.
Right. So this is a very new area of research, and it really requires sort of a shift in mentality for us, because I think most of us have equated remembering with a thing that's difficult. We have to consciously try to remember things, and it's the good guy in our brains, right? It's and forgetting is the bad guy, and there's this war going on between remembering and forgetting, and we just hope that remembering wins. And it's not how it works, and our ability to forget is important to our day-to-day functioning and our ability to remember what matters. So our brains are not designed to remember everything. And people tend to be kind of shocked by this until I really kind of bring it home. So if you think about the stuff that happened, that's your episodic memory. We don't remember most of our own lives. And people are stunned by that and might worry about it for a moment, but it's important that we don't remember all of it, because then we'd be overwhelmed. So we only want to remember what's meaningful, what's emotional, what matters to us. The routine, day-to-day, habitual, same old stuff that happened, our brains thankfully forget. So you probably don't remember what you had for lunch last Wednesday. Do you remember all the texts that you sent and received yesterday?
Right.
Do you remember the details of the laundry you did last week, right? So we don't remember the details of our day-to-day routine stuff, and that's okay. If we kept it, so for example, I every day drive to Starbucks and get a tea, and I park in I park wherever I park. I park in a different parking spot every day. If I retain the memory of every place that I parked my car, when I leave Starbucks today, I might stand there and think I've got, 300 memories of places I've parked online. How am I going to remember where I parked today? So it's important for my brain to forget the previous parking spaces after I've used them. So we lose information intentionally that we don't need, so that we can free up our ability to remember what we pay attention to and what matters.
Lisa Genova is the author of the new book, Remember, The Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting. In your writing of this, you talk about forgetting really as a possible treatment for things like depression and PTSD and even addiction. So with what you just mentioned, how does that work?
Yeah, so this is an interesting new area of study and therapy. The idea is, you know, especially with, you know, so for folks who tend to perseverate on memories that are traumatic or harmful. So like if you're talking about someone with PTSD, for example, or for someone who's addicted and the environmental stimuli, the cues that are associated with drug use can elicit a conditioned response, sort of like Pavlov's bell, and you can't unpair those easily. And so we're stuck in that memory and response. How do we uncouple that? Is there a way that we can make these memories less traumatic, or can we forget them? And so there's this interesting little byproduct of our episodic memories. So that's the memories for stuff that happened. Every time we recall a memory of something that happened, we actually have the opportunity to edit it. And it's our memories for stuff that happened are actually really vulnerable to this. We do it actually without even trying normally. So unlike our memories for stuff we know, like I know that George Washington was the first president. No matter how many times I revisit that memory, I'm not going to change it. It doesn't risk becoming, oh, I think the first president was Abe Lincoln. Like, no, that's locked in. But my memory for stuff that happened can change over time. So every time I recall a memory for something that happened, I'm vulnerable to adding new bits of information into it. So maybe there's something I learned on a radio show or on the news. Maybe a friend also was there when I experienced this event and they had a perspective or saw something I didn't. I'm like, oh yeah, that's interesting. I'll add that in. Not consciously, but we add and subtract and morph, and like depending on the mood or the political views I have now versus I had a long time ago, that might influence how I restore the memory. So every time I recall a memory for something that happened, if I've changed it at all, I actually store those new associations as part of the memory. It overwrites the old one. It's like hitting save on Microsoft Word. The old version of the text is gone, and the new one is what you've got. So what does that mean for folks with PTSD? So if I can't stop reliving that day in combat, that traumatic day, and all of the, you know, the horror and the emotions that go on with it, under the guidance of a therapist, I can revisit that memory in gentler and gentler ways, leaving out the details that are triggering the trauma response in me, so that over time, I will only remember the memory in such a way that it doesn't elicit the horror and the trauma.
Okay, so flip side to that. It is April 1985. I'm a senior in high school, and the rock band The Hooters, they were a big deal at the time, came to our high school to play a gig. I remember doing an interview, being in the auditor, being in the cafeteria waiting for them to come in. I had chicken nuggets. They had chicken nuggets. I remember exactly what seat I was sitting in. And I'm wondering, the reason I ask this is, why do we remember that stuff that is of no importance? And can we edit that out? Like, so that we don't remember these mundane, silly things, and perhaps we can remember important things like when my nephew was born.
Yeah, so that's great. I love this example. So, you know, it might seem silly and mundane now, but I bet that the Hooters coming to your school felt really cool at the time, and it was important because you still remember it. Some of the details, the sensory information associated with them coming to your school is still in your memory today because at the time it was emotional, it was meaningful, you paid attention to it. A lot of us have these kinds of memories. We call them flashbulb memories. So the ones that people can relate to sort of as a public is like, you know, where were you? Who were you with? What were you doing? What time of day was it when JFK was shot? or when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up a year after your concert, when the Twin Towers collapsed on 9/11. So because these were unusual, shocking, emotional, felt somehow personally relevant events, we remember them in vivid detail. Interestingly, this doesn't guarantee that they're accurate. So we think they are. We would bet everything we've got that you remember eating those chicken nuggets and you remember the details of that day, and they feel so vividly remembered that it must be so. But study after study has shown that people, so for example, the Space Shuttle Challenger, a psychologist at Emory College interviewed a bunch of Psych 101 students 24 hours after the explosion. So pretty much right away. And these are like 18 and 19 year olds. So not brains that are old and heading toward Alzheimer's. So they interviewed these kids. Who were you with? What were you feeling? What were you doing when the space shuttle exploded? 2.5 years later, so not that long, they interviewed these same students again, same questions. None of them had all of the answers right. So none of their memory 2.5 years later matched the memory 24 hours after the explosion. Not one of them. And get this, this is even better. When shown their original handwritten answers, if they didn't match the memory they contained now at 2.5 years later, they'd look at the handwritten note and think, well, that's strange. I don't remember writing that. That can't be true. That's not how it happened. That's because they've written over the original memory with new information that differs. And the new information, the new memory, is how you hold it. That's all you've got. And so, yeah, it's your memory for that concert, you still have it because it probably meant something to you at the time. And it's not that you need to get rid of that one to make room for others. It's not competing with your ability to remember new things today. Like, you brought it up now, but it's not top of mind.
Right.
It's sort of like, the songs that we overlearned because they overplayed them on the radio when we were younger. Like, say, you're 20 and there's a song that's popular. Like, for me, like Bananarama.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Remember
yeah.
Bananarama? So I loved Bananarama when I was like 16, but I probably hadn't heard them in like 40 years. And then now I hear it on the radio, Cruel Summer. And I'm like, oh my God, I know all the words still. So it's not that remembering all the words to Bananarama's Cruel Summer is getting in the way of me learning something new today. We have plenty of room, but if it were there every day, like the routine stuff, you want to clear away the day-to-day things enough so that you can pay attention to what matters day-to-day. But the old stuff, if you repeated it enough, if it was emotional enough, it'll stay for a lifetime.
The book is so fascinating, and you write about so many things that are really just, it makes us ultimately feel good, I think. But when you...
Good.
I always like asking scientists like yourself the question, which is, we know a lot about this, and yet there's still a lot we don't know. So what are you still fascinated about that we don't know, that we're still learning about?
Oh, I love this question. Well, it's so true, right? I mean, we know so much about the brain, but it's still, unlike the heart, which is a pump, and the kidneys, which is a filter, here we've got this blob of organic matter in our skull that is actually in a black box, right? Your brain is not exposed to anything. And yet this is how we see and feel and remember and think and desire. So it's endlessly fascinating to me. And we definitely don't know more than we know. So I'm interested in, I'm definitely interested in the neuroscience of memory. So memory doesn't happen in one place. People tend to think of like, oh, it's a memory bank, or it's a file cabinet, or it's a video camera. It's none of those things. It's not like, hitting play on YouTube. It's like an associative scavenger hunt. It's a collection of neural circuitry. But we understand very little about the actual dynamics in real time of the molecular events that actually is a memory. So when I'm thinking about this conversation with you tomorrow, like, what are the molecular events going on in my brain? We don't understand that fully yet. We don't understand fully why we dream. I love this. David Eagleman, who's a neuroscientist you might like, he's got a book out called Live Wired right now. He postulates that we're dreaming because our eyes are shut for all those hours. And so our visual cortex is not being activated. And if it's not being activated all that time, it might be overtaken by your auditory cortex or some other part of your brain that will think, oh, that space isn't being used, I'll use it. And so we dream our dreams tend to be very visual. And so he thinks that we dream because we need to activate that part of our brain that it won't become overtaken. So that's fascinating, and we don't know yet. So it's cool. It's endlessly cool.
It is endlessly cool. And a good place to start is the new book, Remember, The Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting. The book is published by Harmony. Lisa Genova, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book and to have you on the program. I appreciate your time and willingness, and I look forward to having you back.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, Lisa Genova is the author of Remember, The Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.